Coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada, affiliate In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. It was April 1945, and the end of the war in Europe was in sight as the Allied armies pressed their invasion into the German heartland. In Washington, President Roosevelt's health had noticeably deteriorated. His ashen gray complexion and physical weakness raised concerns for his health among friends, family, and associates. The president needed a rest, a chance to recuperate and regain his strength. Accordingly, the president once again traveled to the Little White House in Warm Springs, Georgia. With him went an entourage of friends and relatives. FDR had first visited this health spa, noted for its healing mineral waters, 21 years earlier, in an effort to find relief for his paralyzed lower body. Roosevelt looked forward to 2 weeks of relaxation. At 1 p.m. on April 12, 1945, Roosevelt sat in the living room of his cottage, surrounded by friends and family. As he signed letters and documents, an artist stood painting his portrait at an easel nearby. The conversation was lively, the atmosphere congenial. The president turned to the artist and reminded her that they had only 15 minutes left in the session. Suddenly, he grabbed his head, complaining of a sharp pain. The president was suffering a massive cerebral hemorrhage that would end his life in minutes. America's longest-serving president, who had led the nation through the Great Depression and World War II, was dead. "Well, forget all that," says Steve Ubaney. "Everything you think you know about how FDR died is wrong." Steve Ubaney joins me next on Coast to Coast AM. Steve Ubaney is an American suspense author who reinvestigates the deaths of famous people using newly discovered facts that debunk historical claims. His books deduce that some of history's most famous deaths were actually murders. And he is back with a brand new one in his Who Murdered series. This one is Who Murdered FDR, the true story they don't want you to know. Steve Ubaney, welcome back to Coast. How are you?
Richard, I'm great. It's a pleasure to be back.
I have to tell you, after we did that that program on Who Murdered Elvis back in August, I received just a deluge of email, people arguing back and forth, because for many people, this was such new information. And here we go again, this time FDR, and I expect sort of a similar reaction. These Who Murdered books, I mean, how do people receive them? Obviously, you know, people are they're flying off the bookshelves. People are buying them, but do you get also some pushback because you're this is kind of uncomfortable for some people. You're pulling their reality out from under them.
Yeah, I'm playing with people's normalcy bias, and they don't like it. You know, people like to think that you know, people always tend to believe the first story we're told. You know. And some of the stories that were first told did not depict the longest photos. You know, in World War II, of course, you know, the victor was. But, you know, a lot of history has been sanitized, you know, and people don't like it when you reinvestigate things and you kind of pull the rug out from under them. You know, and in the case of the things that I write, I'm fascinated by history, and I just reinvestigate what's already been out there. Just because I have an, I like to question things and I like history and I just have an interest in mind. So I have to be very careful when I write the books not to fall into confirmation bias. Confirmation bias meaning, confirmation bias. Finding just the facts that you want to bring you to that certain conclusion. I have to be very careful not to fall into that because out of every four or five books that I start to look into, and then one might make it. With the information that I find. So it's not like I just say, well, let's write this and let's make the information work. It doesn't work that way. The information takes you where it has to go. So,
right. Now, in the case of FDR, you know, this is 70, almost 75 years ago, three quarters of a century. I mean, was it difficult at this stage in the game to reopen this very, very cold case?
They're always difficult. Because I never want to know. You know, I think there's a germ seed inside all of us that likes truth, justice, and the American way, and you don't want to think anything sinister is going on, you know, behind your back, and so they're all They're all coming.
I just mean finding the documents.
I'm sorry, say again?
I just mean finding the documents, uncovering the real facts of the case after all this time.
Well, what I did is I went to the Roosevelt Mansion in upstate in Hyde Park, New York, which is a terrific place. If you ever get a chance to go and spend a day or two to do it. And a beautiful place, and the Roosevelt Mansion's on beautiful grounds. But overhead is the National Archives. So I spent a tremendous amount of time in the National Archives going through things that were top secret previously. And there are huge files there on FDR and his wife, Eleanor, and communism. There's a three-drawer filing cabinet right in the middle of the floor that I almost fell over, actually, that has Eleanor Roosevelt's connection to communism. She was being investigated for being a communist. So, you know, you would have never had that information years ago, you know. So that's where the majority of the information came from, is from the original documents, and turned out to be quite a book. And the views are pretty good. As far as rubbing people the wrong way, I think everybody rubs somebody the wrong way if you're doing something. You know, I don't even listen to them.
Right. Well, truth is often uncomfortable. It's not about necessarily making people feel good. It's like a scorpion. Sometimes it stings. Needless to say, you don't paint a flattering picture of FDR. You mentioned communism, although, you know, let's be honest, communism was kind of the fad back then, before people knew, I guess, the real truth about what was happening in Stalinist Russia and the pogroms and the forced starvations in the Ukraine and so forth. Let's talk about a young FDR. Talk about someone born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Paint me a portrait of a young FDR.
You know, FDR was, I always say he was beneficiary of the Lucky Sperm Club. This guy was born into a family who, you know, I mean, this is old world wealth. I mean, they're on ground where a quarter mile down the road is the Vanderbilt Mansion. You know, they're on the same basic parcel of land. I mean, to say that this guy was wealthy and had every single thing that he has ever desired was an understatement. You know, they had everything when people had nothing. So he was full of the devil. He was out goofing around, was not a stellar student, C's all the way through school. He'd rather goof off and go play football and so forth. And I can't use the words that I want to use, but he was something. He was really, he was really something. Anything that he wanted was there for the asking. And his political career started out through the Roosevelt name and through being helped into positions. And it blossomed into being governor of New York. A lot of people don't know FDR was governor of New York. That, or they forgot, or they're just not talking about it anymore. And, he used the Roosevelt name, married his cousin. Eleanor Roosevelt was born a Roosevelt, married a Roosevelt, died a Roosevelt, which is a little odd. The woman never had to change her monogram her entire life, actually. So, this is the evolution of this person.
Now, his cousin, Teddy, was a distant cousin? Was he a second or third cousin?
I think it was a second cousin.
Right. And he was a Republican. How did he perceive his younger cousin, the Democrat?
Well, they get along really well. FDR's father wasn't too thrilled about it, because that was just not the way that he was raised. But that Roosevelt name, FDR would have done anything to try and get ahead. He was extraordinarily goal-oriented, especially when it comes to politics. So he did a lot of things that were unsavory to advance himself, and marrying his cousin and befriending the... you got to remember, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, that name carries an awful lot of weight. So, you know, he was... He benefited from the Roosevelt name as well. So
right, and he was also governor of New York. He was also governor of New York, which has always been sort of a stepping stone to the White House.
Yeah, it has happened that way through history. Absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
And a young FDR didn't exactly have the common touch, did he? I mean, he didn't have I think of George Bush Sr. trying to buy socks in Kmart back in the, do you remember that back in 1988? He tried to show people he was the common man. And there was a famous TV report. He's trying to buy a pair of socks at Kmart to show, you know, well, he's just one of us. And he had no idea what to do when he got up to the cash register.
it's funny how they live amongst us, but they have no idea what the hell we're about. It's incredible, really. The ultra-rich, posturing, preening people who just didn't have any idea about us or what we do, you know. And sometimes I wonder if they really want to, but it's in the FBI.
Right. It's like they lived in the clouds. But had he not contracted polio, he may have been president, but it certainly changed the trajectory of his life, as you would imagine it would, but also his politics. Talk to me about how polio affected FDR more than just physically.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is where I gained a lot of respect for FDR. I was not necessarily an FDR fan. I'm not much of a socialist personally. But, you know, when somebody comes down with infantile paralysis to the point where all they can move is their head and they fight their way back using sheer will, installing bars over the bed so they can use their arms and then dragging their body to try and get themselves to walk every day and been unsuccessful. When that happened to him, you know, FDR was started to, you know, obviously, you know, world-renowned treatments came in. None of them actually worked. He started to identify with people who were suffering and who were needy. It was a gigantic slice of humble pie. It actually changed his life.
Right. I mean, he displayed, you'd have to call it heroism in the face of this this disease. I mean, didn't he basically drag his, he had crutches and ramps, but he would drag himself for miles.
Yeah, every day he had this regimen that, you know, he had parallel bars installed out in front of the Roosevelt Mansion. And they fashioned these braces, and he would use crutches, and he would, and it's just incredible to think about today. He had, you know, 12 pounds of steel on each leg, and he's dragging himself with his feet to the parallel bars where he's exercising his arms, and then from the parallel bars, the closest route in front of Hyde Park, and then he's turning around and dragging himself back, and, you know, quote-unquote walking, trying to take steps. And, you know, I mean, it's just, he talked about ironclad will. I mean, that was really something else. Want to come back that bad. And then, of course, he ended up in Warm Springs, Georgia, where the warm waters would suit his legs. And he met children and other people with other afflictions. And that's what really impacted his life, to identify with people in need and suffering. So it really changed his life, for sure.
And then the fast track to the White House, just sort of we've got about five minutes before we head into the break at the bottom of the hour. But let's just give me a thumbnail sketch of his journey to the White House. Does it start with Governor of New York, or is it Under Secretary of the Navy?
His track for the White House started with Woodrow Wilson and Colonel House, actually, who Woodrow Wilson was his idol. Colonel House was Woodrow Wilson's, well, they didn't know it at the time, but he was a Stalin plant. And they fell in love with this communist ideal. And, you know, of course, they didn't know anything about it, really, but it was just a new great thing. And it was through Colonel House and FDR's connection that he ended up being Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And from there, he continued to use the Roosevelt name and the political connections in New York to run for governor. And then once governor, jumped to the White House for him. And he happened to come out at a time when he really, some of the things that FDR wanted to do Hoover wanted to do. But, you know, he would, you know, he didn't cooperate very well with Hoover. Some of those were his ideas. And, you know, FDR jumped right to, he jumped right to the White House and, you know, started, he originally ran on tax cuts and everything. And when he realized that that all wasn't working, he completely flipped and went, you know, to the socialist end of it and, you know, worked amazingly well for him. He knew the country was suffering, so.
Right. Well, we'll get into the New Deal and the Depression and so forth and the fact that we'll do this after the break, but I just wanted to mention the idea that someone in a confined to a wheelchair or that had such a debilitating disease, polio, for that person to rise to the White House at a time when, as you point out in Who Murdered FDR, at a time when a physical handicap like this was oft also equated with sort of feebleness of mind, and how, without, I guess, the complicity of the media that sort of agreed, you know, to not talk about it, he never would have been president.
You know, it's amazing the parallels. He had a very cooperative, very sympathetic media. You know, just like today, you know. just like today with our president, you know, very cooperative and very sympathetic.
Sure.
Yeah.
But, absolutely. You know, he gets a free pass.
Yeah. The parallels between these two guys we'll have to talk about when you get back. But it's all history basically is repeating itself. With the Russians and the White House and, you know, just all kinds of things. It's incredible how it's happening again, and no one catches it, you know. That's really something else.
But how is it that that no one sort of, you know, noticed or said, hey, wait a minute, our president is in a wheelchair or he can barely walk. Is he equipped? You know, this is the thinking back then, mm-hmm. and obviously we know better now, but the idea that back, you know, 70, 80 years ago, that no one would take notice of that.
Well, they picked their camera shots well, and FDR could fool people for a time. FDR was a genius. This was a guy who could really think on four or five thought processes at one time. This guy was really, really, really something. So what he would do is he would, with help of someone on one arm, he would loop their arm, and the help of a crutch or a cane or something at the other arm, he would appear to be walking. He could take a couple of steps. So they could hide this, you know, behind podiums or with the different camera shots. And, you know, they did it remarkably well. So they didn't, to ward off the fact that in case anything did leak out, he paid an insurance company to go public and claim that, you know, I'm an insurance man, so fit, we're insuring him for X amount of dollars. So, I mean, the propaganda and, you know, those wheels were in motion even back then. You know, it's just that the media was smaller and easier to control. Obviously, we didn't have Facebook. We didn't have other things, you know, cell phones and cameras on the phones, and, you know, they could pick things wisely, and they did. And it worked for them.
When he won the first election, you know, the whole idea of the 100 days, those first 100 days, which are seen as being so important today in the media, what does the president accomplish in his first 100 days? That really started with FDR, didn't it? But he kind of cheated that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely he did. This is complicated. How do I describe this? The 20th Amendment had changed the date in which the president was going to be sworn in from March until January. So the amendment didn't go into effect until October of 1933, which meant that Roosevelt had to wait to take office for four extra months. So this mystery thing of the 100 days, and they still judge presidents by what they accomplished in 100 days. FDR had waited more than 100 days because of the change in the...
Right, he had a four month head start. Listen, we'll take a time out. We'll come back, Steve, and talk about the New Deal and the Depression and communism and much more. Who Murdered FDR? Joe Cocker, Hide Your Love Away, into the break on Coast to Coast AM. I'm here to tell you, folks, our maps are all wrong. All of them, they're wrong. And a scientist has created a representation of what the world really looks like. A true map of the world, and you can check it out. It's posted in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. Our webmaster, Sean Latasore, tonight is all over that, and he's posted that there. Many countries, for example, including Russia and Canada, are not nearly as big as we think. And the problem is it's very difficult to portray the reality of a spherical world on a flat map. And so you get this distortion. It's called the Mercator projection, the map that's most commonly seen hanging in classrooms and in textbooks. It was created back in 1596. I think it's maybe time we update that. Anyway, it was designed to help sailors navigate the world, the Mercator projection. But it seriously distorts the size of land masses. So, for example, you may have noticed that while Africa is around 14 times larger than Greenland, and yet on the map, both are almost the same size. Greenland is huge on these maps. Brazil, another example. Brazil is more than 5 times larger than Alaska, yet Alaska is much larger than Brazil on the map, much larger. The map also suggests that Scandinavian countries are larger than India, whereas in reality, India is 3 times the size of all Scandinavian countries put together. It looks like Europe is larger than North America on these old maps, but in reality, the reverse is true. Russia isn't as large as it's depicted, with Africa larger than Russia in reality. So if you want to see the world as it really is represented on a map, you want to check out this fascinating story, again, in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. Back to Who Murdered FDR? The true story they don't want you to know. We'll find out who they are a little later. Steve Eubany, my guest. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Steve Eubany, my guest. Who murdered FDR? You know, when people put out these lists, you know, the greatest presidents and so forth, FDR is often on those lists, you know, right up there with Lincoln and Washington and Kennedy, of course. But FDR is one of those presidents that you either loved him or you hated him. And he certainly made a lot of enemies right out of the gates. Let's talk a little bit about what was happening in America when he came into the White House. And of course, the United States at this point is mired in a horrible, devastating depression, like 50% unemployment, and the bank system had failed. And just sort of paint that picture for us, how bad it was.
It was pretty bad. You know, the president preceding Hoover had a roaring economy going. And of course, I mean, remember the roaring 20s? Well, there we go. You know, things were starting to, we were starting to be able to afford luxuries in the country. Well, Hoover got in and fiddled with the knobs and levers and raised a few taxes and put some regulations on and cured that fast. And, you know, so here comes FDR, and he realizes there's a lot of people who are really in trouble and suffering. So he has this explosion of legislation in order to help these people, and or so he thought. And he did. He did a great deal of help for a lot of people. He put people to work, and it was on the government paycheck. And this was the experiment from the communists. The Communist Party of the United States of America had already set up camp in 1919 in this country. Okay, so all of this information was coming through his friends in the Communist Party of the United States of America, and they're still in existence, by the way, and they're near New York City. And so this was their idea of how to help the workers and the working class, and it was a flood of legislation. Where they just basically regulated everything from banking to basically if you were able to take oxygen, FDR regulated it at that point. Everything from farms to banking to the Securities Act and all points in between. So this was done to put everyone to work on the government dole so we could have this cradle-to-grave wonderful society that Stalin and the Soviets had, you know, fooled us into thinking existed. New ideology. They thought that it was going to be this great thing where we were going to escape the peaks and valleys of communism, and you know the government was in charge of everything, and oh, isn't it wonderful?
Peaks and valleys of capitalism, I think you meant. I think you said communism. So the peaks and valleys
of capitalism. I'm sorry about that.
Right.
You know,
no worries.
The pitfalls and valleys, you know, of capitalism, you know, so.
Right. You print the list of legislative actions that were enacted in Who Murdered FDR. Let me just read here. And the Emergency Banking Act, the Government Economy Act, the Beer Wine Revenue Act, the creation of the Civilian Conservation Corps, abandonment of Gold Standard, the Federal Emergency Relief Act, Agricultural Adjustment Act, Emergency Farm Mortgage Act, Tennessee Valley Authority Act, Securities Act, abrogation of Gold Payment Clause, Homeowners Loan Act, Glass-Steagall Banking Act, National Industrial Recovery Act, Emergency Railroad Transportation Act, and the Farm Credit Act. He did this really without much cooperation from the Congress, didn't he?
He just basically rammed it through. I wasn't going to bore everybody with that, Richard. I'm glad you did that. I wasn't going
to
do that.
I'm happy to bore them with it. I mean, it's just a laundry list, but it gives you a sense, because you mentioned, you know, that this was right out of almost like the Communist Manifesto, that he had the kind of control that Stalin had in the Soviet Union, which is kind of an interesting parallel.
It's very true. Granted, it was the Walt Disney version of it, but it certainly was the same basic control. He was king, just like Stalin. Stalin just purged all of his enemies. You know, if you got in the way of Stalin, you know, you ended up dead. His first two wives, his doctor, who he told things to, you know, he just went crazy. The Great Purge was basically show trials to put anybody to death that either disagreed with him or could challenge him politically.
So that's how Stalin did it. FDR did it by what? Packing the Supreme Court.
Right. What happened is by 1936, he had worried, you know, there was an election coming. So, you know, he thought that people were getting a little bit, you know, weary of the New Deal, so he came out with a second New Deal. It also wasn't working to the extent that he thought. Okay. So while all of this is going on in Europe, this great war is brewing, you know, he's, you know, that's Europe's war. We're going to do our thing. We're in trouble. We're staying out of it. So if this was great, a second New Deal must be better. So they start to implement the second New Deal, and they start to realize that substantial portions of it were unconstitutional. So he had to pack the Supreme Court to see if he could get it passed, and it was, I mean, he was really, really fiddling with things. I mean, a tremendous amount. And I know in the history books say a lot of things. I know the history books paint him as this wonderful, magical genie of economic success. He wasn't. It was an economic failure. People were, they were surviving, and that was about it. That was about all they were doing. And, you know, unless we got into that war and started to move some goods and services, we were, you know, we were still going to be in the New Deal until his death. I mean, it was a catastrophe.
How did he use the Trading with the Enemy Act to gain more power?
Lend-lease.
Explain. Trading with the Enemy Act.
Well. Again, what he did was, that was just an attempt to bolster the economy. And it was the same thing with the Lend-Lease program. He was moving, you know, munitions and goods and services to defeat the Axis powers. And he was giving them to our allies, you know, Free France included, and eventually the Soviet Union, so that we could win. And they were just running up the cash register to be paid back at a later time. So there's a lot going on here. I mean, he had to do that because he started to realize the New Deal was not working. So there was a lot going on economically in our country. And there came to a point where he knew that we had to get into this war. And the spies in deep. And, you know, we have spies too. I know it sounds terrible. We do. All countries have them. We have spies too. Our spies in Germany were starting to tell us, they're finishing your heavy water experiments. And with the V-2 rockets to carry the nuclear weapons to all points of the globe, we'd be speaking German right now. I mean, they were on the brink. So we had to get into this war for economic reasons and for other reasons. So there's a great catalyst here of what's going on. Fascinating time in history. Scary time in history.
So in the book, you argue, as many have, that FDR knew a Japanese attack on the U.S. was coming. The only question was when. But then the question is, did he sort of make it happen? Did he let it happen? Or was he just sort of glad it happened?
You know, I say in my book that I think FDR was probably the greatest war president we ever had, and that's because he just loved war. He did everything to make World War II happen, and I'm going to catch flack for that. But you know what? Two words. Too bad. It's true, all right? The Japanese, they're an oil debtor nation, meaning they don't create enough oil to run what they have to do in their country. So they're getting our oil from us. They were coming off a huge war with China. They didn't. The last thing they wanted was to go to war against us. So they were trying to negotiate and negotiate and negotiate. And what happened was we shut off the oil spigot to them, which forced them to go island hopping. We had already broken the Japanese communication code. So what happened was a civil war kind of happened in Japan. Imperial Japan took over. They're no longer negotiating. Now they're going to get oil by force. So it forced them in a situation to go island hopping. Okay. So that's what happened in the Pacific. As far as Germany is concerned, and I'm not taking our enemy's part, trust me, okay, as far as Germany is concerned, Germany is a food debtor nation, meaning they don't create enough food to feed themselves. So we set up blockades around Germany, so we couldn't feed them. They weren't getting any food. So you see these emaciated photos of people in concentration camps, which is tremendously horrible. You know, Hitler had to make a decision: do I feed my soldiers or do I feed my prisoners? So that's the other side of history that people don't really get. We had already broken the Japanese codes. I had a conversation about this with Oliver Stone, 2013. He came out with a series, The Other Side of History, I believe, a DVD series.
Yes, yes.
He came out and he said the exact same thing. And this book was in the middle of writing this back then, or researching it at least, because I do all my own research. And, you know, he came up with his own research to substantiate the same thing. So it wasn't a matter of if, it was just a matter of when. It had to happen.
And so again, did he let it happen? Did he, well, in part, I suppose he was sort of, they were prodding the Japanese, maybe cornering them a little bit, but how much foreknowledge do you think he had of the actual attack?
It's difficult to tell. I know they had at least a week's notice. And, you know, the aircraft carriers mysteriously went out of Pearl Harbor. So they were not at Pearl Harbor when the attack happened, which is a little suspicious. You know, aircraft carriers tend to be a pretty necessary commodity in a war like that, in every war, actually. So, you know, they had to spare them, so they left the harbor. If I'm wrong, sorry, but, I mean, I can't imagine a situation where you would be taking aircraft carriers and ordering them away from a place that you're supposed to be protecting. So it was a pretty good evidence to support that, you know, the same, you know, to support that conclusion that they definitely had. As a matter of fact, the History Channel broke it, I think, last year. I was watching something on the History Channel. They even said they had uncovered documents, internal documents, which I didn't find in the archive, that suggest that very thing, that the codes were broken. And I thought, wow, hey, look at that. You know, I mean, I knew I got it right, but I didn't know how right I got it. So I was right on the money with it.
Right, but as you make great pains to point out, and you just mentioned this earlier, that the Germans and their V2 rocket program almost were getting close to being able to deliver nuclear bombs. And had the United States not gotten in, when they did, it may have been too late. And imagine nuclear weapons attached to those V2 rockets raining down on England.
You know, it's incredible. It's just absolutely incredible when you think about the situation. You know, America's in economic chaos. They know they have to get into this war for many reasons to spark the economy as well. And it was just, and he had FDR was put in a real bad situation. And, you know, in the first chapter of my book, I paint FDR as kind of a villain. And I have to do that to set up the murder, so I apologize in advance for anybody who reads that and gets their tail in a knot. But FDR had to sell our country on this war. And I believe he had to sacrifice Pearl Harbor and the lives at it. I know it's a terrible thing to say, but I think that that's how it happened.
In order to galvanize public support.
Right, yeah, because he had already been saying, this is Europe's war, this is Europe's war. Well, between the horrible economy, which is not doing anything, and the necessary time to get into the war coming through our spies, he knew it was time to, very gut-wrenching decision, very gut-wrenching decision. So that's how that came to pass. You know.
Now, before we get into the U.S. in World War II and FDR's relationship with Churchill and then later Stalin, just talk to me a little bit about sort of the enemies list that he had already cultivated through, you know, the overregulation and with the big corporations in the United States.
Oh boy, this guy had. You know, there were enemies. He hated money. He really did. And in fact, he confiscated as much gold as he could get his hands on. So, you know, he really, anybody who was interested in industry or making money was definitely not his friend. I mean, he really pissed off some powerful people. I'll run through the list here of the ones that I came up with. The DuPont family, George Eastman from Eastman Kodak, Harvey Firestone, Samuel Colgate Toothpaste, Henry Ford, Carnegie Steelhead, Henry Frick, the Heinz family, the Hilton family who had hotels, the Mellon family who was in charge of the World Banks, William Tubman who was the president of Liberia, and even Robert Woodruff who was chairman of the board of Coca-Cola. I mean, these people would have done anything to get this guy out of power because he was costing them millions of dollars, not only in production, but in personal wealth. So he certainly had some enemies, and here we're starting to get into the motive of murder. And as with all of my books, I run all the suspects through motive, means, and opportunity to come up with the person or people connected to this and how it happened. And I just want to jump in and tell everybody, don't buy this book on Amazon. I'm currently butting heads with Amazon. I pulled all my stock from Amazon. Go to my personal website and buy the book there. The website is whomurderedbooks.com. Three words, whomurderedbooks.com. Lowercase, all one word. Go there, and I make sure you get a book. And with Christmas coming, I don't know how you can satisfy a Christmas gift for $16. You know, you can get some people off your Christmas list that way.
All right. Who Murdered FDR? The True Story They Don't Want You to Know. Steve Eubany, my guest. When we come back on the other side, we'll talk about the United States entering the Second World War, FDR's relationship with Roosevelt or with Churchill and Stalin. And then, of course, we notice that FDR starts to look very frail, very sickly during the Tehran conference and later, of course, Yalta. We'll discover what actually happened to the 32nd president of the United States.